pre-recorded with information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded with information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream media distorted. We come and listen and support it. 6 foot six above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. 6 foot six above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. 6 foot six above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. 6 foot six above sea level.
Hello, I'm David Harper with the BBC News. Pressure is growing on Hamas to accept what the US has described as a generous ceasefire deal. It's hoped the new proposals, already approved by Israel, could finally lead to a breakthrough. Here's our Middle East regional editor, Mike Thompson.
After many months of fractured talks, mediated by Qatar, Egypt and the US, hopes are high. Hamas has long demanded an end to the fighting, Israel only a pause. Now there's compromise, with talk of the restoration of sustainable calm and at least a 40-day ceasefire. Israel has slightly lowered the number of hostages Hamas must release in exchange for Palestinian prisoners in Israel. And many displaced Palestinians in southern Gaza would be allowed to return to their homes in the north, a key Hamas demand.
Washington has appealed to the United Arab Emirates, among other countries, to stop providing support to the warring parties in Sudan. The US ambassador to the UN said the Sudanese army and the rival RSF paramilitaries were both receiving support, which was leading to the destruction of Sudan and the displacement of millions. Kenyan officials say at least 50 people, including many children, have been killed after a dam collapsed following torrential rainfall. Residents spoke of frantic efforts to pull people out of the raging flood in the dark or dig them out of the mud. Two villages near Mai Mahiu in the Rift Valley were badly hit. The BBC's Ian Wafula is there.
I'm standing in the middle of what was once a village, home to 18 families, and now their homes are no more. Water from a nearby dam came down, streaming from that hill, taking everything alongside it, leaving nothing to chance. And the Kenya Red Cross says at this point, 109 people have been rescued and rushed to different hospitals nearby. The numbers could unfortunately go higher just because quite a number of people are still missing. And that is what the authorities here are anticipating, even as rescue operations go on.
Ecuador has filed a complaint at the International Court of Justice against the Mexican government over its decision to grant asylum to a former vice president accused of corruption. Ecuador accuses Mexico of interfering in its internal affairs. Our Americas regional editor Leonardo Rocha reports.
Jorge Glass entered the Mexican embassy in mid-December after a local court ordered his arrest. Ecuador's former vice president had already served prison time for corruption, which he denied, and said the latest ruling was also politically motivated. Ecuador's government said Mexico had illegally granted him political asylum to shield him from law enforcement. Earlier this month, Ecuadorian security forces stormed the embassy building in the middle of the night and arrested Mr. Glass. The US and most countries in the region condemned the operation, saying it violated the basic principles of diplomacy. Mr. Glass was taken to a high-security prison in Guayaquil, where a few days later he attempted suicide.
Leonardo Rocha reporting. World News from the BBC. Two international mining companies involved in one of Brazil's worst environmental disasters 9 years ago have proposed paying $25 billion in compensation. The Brazilian government has asked them to improve their settlement offer. 19 people were killed and dozens of towns were flooded when a dam used to hold toxic mining waste collapsed in the city of Mariana. Norway has taken another step towards the controversial mining of its seabed by inviting potential players to nominate blocks they might want to exploit. Seabed minerals can be used in generating wind and solar power, as well as batteries and computers. Oslo says it wants to reduce reliance on China and other authoritarian countries for these minerals. But ecological groups worry it'll damage deep sea ecosystems and spread pollution. Iraqi officials say nearly 700 Iraqis have been repatriated from the sprawling Al-Hol camp in northwest Syria. The camp, guarded by US-backed Kurdish forces, is home to nearly 43,000 wives, widows and children of Islamic State jihadists from more than 40 countries. The repatriated Iraqis have been taken to a rehabilitation camp near Iraq's northern city of Mosul. English Premier League football clubs have agreed in principle to introduce a new spending cap. If approved at June's Premier League meeting, the new model will come into force from the 2026 season, Laura Scott reports.
There is a delicate balance to strike between trying to keep the Premier League competitive whilst not undermining the ability of clubs to compete with their European counterparts. Clubs had already approved rules which make the spending on players' wages dependent on club revenues. But what clubs discussed at the meeting in London was an additional financial control, known as anchoring. This would tie the spending limits of any club to a percentage of the television revenue and the prize money of the lowest earning side. A majority of clubs voted in favour of doing further analysis of this model and drafting the rules.
BBC News.
Are you passionate about community music and local voices? I'm Jay Davis, and I'm thrilled to share an exciting opportunity with you.
I'm Tom Davis, a proud member of the programming committee at WORT. We're the heartbeat of Madison, shaping the airwaves with diverse, engaging, and community-driven content. But to keep the beats flowing, we need your help.
Since you're listening to WORT right now, you may be aware of this, but this is more than just a radio station. It's a platform for local expression, a hub for artists, and a stage for community voices. Join our programming committee and become a driving force behind what goes on our airwaves.
Whether you're into music, news, culture, or something entirely unique, we want your voice in the mix.
Visit our website at wortfm.org/programming-committee, or you can email me directly with j.davis@wortfm.org, and we can start the conversation.
WORT, where your voice matters.
The following is a rebroadcast of a Madison BookBeat episode, which originally aired on February 1st, 2021. Enjoy.
Hello again, friends, and welcome to Madison BookBeat, your listener-sponsored community radio home for Madison authors, topics, book events, and publishers. I'm your host, Stu Levitan. Our guest today is Professor Francine Hirsch, the Vilas Distinguished Achievement Professor of History at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and author of Soviet Judgment at Nuremberg, A New History of the International Military Tribunal After World War II. Published by Oxford University Press, it is an award-winning reappraisal of the trial that became the pivot point between World War II and the Cold War. On November 20, 1945, the United States, Great Britain, France, and the Soviet Union opened the International Military Tribunal at Nuremberg, Germany, putting on trial 22 Nazi leaders and seven organizations charged with conspiring in a crime against peace, planning and waging wars of aggression, participating in war crimes, and committing crimes against humanity. On September 30 and October 1, 1946, judges from the four countries announced their verdicts. 12 of the accused, including Reich Marshal Hermann Göring and German Foreign Minister Joachim von Ribbentrop, were sentenced to death by hanging. Seven received prison sentences ranging from 10 years to life, and three were acquitted. Four organizations, the Leadership Corps of the Nazi Party, the Secret State Police, or Gestapo, the Protective Squadron, or SS, and the Security Service, or SD, were found criminal, but only for what they did after the start of the war on September 1, 1939. Three organizations, the Reich Cabinet, the Stormtroopers, or SA, and the General German Staff and High Command, were found not guilty. In the collective memory of the West, these Nuremberg trials, the only four-power trials, were first and foremost an American exercise of finding truth and dispensing justice. Chief U.S. Prosecutor Robert H. Jackson, on leave from his job as Associate Justice of the United States Supreme Court, was both star and director, with able prosecutors from Great Britain in friendly support. The French were only marginally relevant, and the Soviets, well, they were at best an annoyance and at worst an embarrassment, whose obvious and overwhelming conflicts threatened the very legitimacy of the entire exercise. But what if that Nuremberg moment was just a myth and our memory is not of the whole story? What if, notwithstanding their own dealings with Hitler and their own war atrocities, the Soviets were actually essential to the tribunal happening at all? What if, notwithstanding their own show trials, it was a Soviet lawyer who came up with the fundamental breakthrough in international law underpinning the entire tribunal? Those are the questions that Professor Hirsch asks and answers brilliantly in this landmark account, for which she has already received the American Society for International Law's 2021 Certificate of Merit for a preeminent contribution to creative scholarship. It is no surprise that Fran Hirsch has produced such a work of scholarship and style. Her first book, Empire of Nations, Ethnographic Knowledge and the Making of the Soviet Union, received awards from the American Historical Association, the American Association for the Advancement of Slavic Studies, and the Council for European Studies. As you can tell, Professor Hirsch specializes in Russian and Soviet history, modern European history, comparative empires, the history of human rights, and Russian-American engagement. She also has a very healthy 4.4 rating on Rate My Professor. It is a pleasure to welcome to Madison BookBeat, Professor Francine Hirsch.
Oh my goodness, thank you so much for having me here. And I feel like speechless now after such a lovely introduction. And also thank you for such a wonderful summary of some of the main issues that I went to the archives with. So I appreciate that so much.
75 years later, why does the International Military Tribunal at Nuremberg matter?
That's the big question, isn't it? Why does Nuremberg still matter? I think it matters for so many reasons, and there are so many ways to get at that question. It matters in our current political climate, I think, right now, in part because people are still talking about the Nuremberg trials, whether they're talking about having a trial of the Trump administration, or whether we're talking about the current International Criminal Court and the United States' relationship to it, whether we're talking about trials with whether China should be tried for crimes against humanity, against the Uyghurs. There are so many issues today. Nuremberg comes up again and again and again. One of the things I think when we talk about Nuremberg, of the way that we think about Nuremberg in the popular consciousness, we really do have a somewhat simplified version of the story. Again, this story about American leadership, this story about Robert Jackson, it's again, you know, America leading the way. And I think that the richer story of the Nuremberg, one that brings in the Soviet Union, it's not just about bringing in the Soviet Union, but it's a story of international cooperation. And I think that that's what I really want us to hold on to in some ways. It's not always easy to cooperate with other governments that are very different from us. Cooperate in the aim of something higher. I think that that's one of the important lessons. But again, if we're going to keep invoking Nuremberg, I think we need to know what really happened in that courtroom and what really happened in that city at the end of the war.
Not just in the courtroom, but how we got to the courtroom. And as I alluded in the introduction, Soviet participation in Nuremberg was, to say the least, complicated. They had a non-aggression pact and secret protocols with Germany. They engaged in scripted secret show trials. They massacred 20,000 Polish officers and intelligentsia in the Katyn Forest in 1940. But would there have even been an international military tribunal without them?
I don't think that there would have been, or it would have been something so different that it's hard to imagine. One of the things I write about in the book is how it was the Soviets who were really the ones who are out in front, really during the darkest days of the war. In October 1942, Molotov, Soviet foreign minister, makes a public announcement that they want to hold a special international tribunal to bring Nazi leaders to justice and inviting all interested governments to be involved in that process. And before that, in the spring of 1942, the Soviets appealed to their own international lawyers to study the question of reparations and how it relates to international law, and to study this question of whether the leaders of a state can be held criminally responsible for war crimes and for atrocities. And the reason that they're the ones who are out in front is because they've experienced the horrors of Nazi occupation in the war. And so that's part of what pushes them to think about this question. Initially, during the war, the Americans and the British, they're very skeptical about the idea of a trial, of an international tribunal, for reasons that are understandable, right? They're concerned about retribution against American forces. This idea of a trial, it's something that the Soviets, they're comfortable with for all kinds of reasons that we can talk more about. They have certain ideas of what a trial will demonstrate. It's towards the end of the war. Well, it's at the very end when it's clear that there's going to be victory. That's when the U.S. government becomes to get more interested in this question of a tribunal. And by that point, some of these ideas of the Soviet jurist, Aaron Chayinin, have traveled. There have been these international discussions. This term, crimes against peace, that Chayinin had coined, that's now being talked about by the United Nations War Crimes Commission in London. Chayinin's work travels. There's a big push from the Soviets early on that helped really set the stage in some ways for what will happen later.
What problems did the four powers have in setting the basic principles of the trial and drafting an indictment?
That's a really interesting question as well. The thing was that the Soviets and the French had more of a civil law system, and the Americans and the British had more of a common law system. And in the Soviet and French system, an indictment also contained all the evidence. It contained the whole laying out of the case. It also contained a whole history of everything that had happened before. So the indictment is, in this case at Nuremberg, it's a massive document. It's kind of the size of a novella. And then there's all of these attachments to it with all of this evidence. And so in the writing of the indictment, all kinds of things come into play that are going to be essential, like just really big moments later in the trial itself. Because first of all, it's a list of the charges. And the Soviets decide to use the indictment to blame a crime that they themselves had committed, the Katyn massacre, to blame it on the Nazis. And so they insist on including this crime in the war crime section. And so that becomes a really big issue. The other issue with the indictment is that, again, if you're telling the history of the war, it's also a question of, you know, what do you include? Like, what don't you include? How do you talk about the Munich Pact of 1938, in which the French and the British appeased Hitler, right, and handed over to Sudetenland? How do you talk about the Non-Aggression Pact, the Hitler-Stalin Pact, Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, right? It's called all those things. How do you talk about that? And the Soviets were very concerned about this. In the Soviet documents, in the correspondence, you see the Soviets are worried that they want to make sure that this does not get talked about as a springboard for the invasion of Poland. And we're not even talking yet about the secret protocols. This is just even how you describe the actual pact itself. And so these deliberations about what gets included in the indictment, they're very, very tense. And you know, the Americans and the British, to talk a little about the Katyn issue, they try to convince the Soviet chief prosecutor, Roman Rudenko, just like, why are you going down this road? Like, why do you want to do this? They suspect that the Soviets are guilty. There's not enough evidence that they have, again, the people who are in Nuremberg, the Americans and British in Nuremberg, to feel convinced of this, but they have their suspicions. But they say that, you know, it's been a political hot potato. So regardless of like whether the Soviets did it or whether the Germans did it, like, do you really want to bring it up in the trial? And Rudenko tells them, like, I have no choice. You know, my hands are tied. And there are a couple of issues that come up. And at a certain point, he says to them, look, if you really want to change these things, I'm going to have to go back to Moscow. I'm going to have to talk to Stalin. This is going to take weeks, and it's going to hold the whole thing up. And at that point, they just kind of give in on this. And I, you know, interesting, like, my heart kind of breaks for Jackson a little bit on this one, because again, one of the wonderful sources I have from the Library of Congress are Jackson's diaries from this period. And, you know, there's the indictment is called the Indictment Act, right? The Indictment Act gets published the day after Jackson gets intelligence from US Army intelligence they're saying, like, look, it really looks like the Soviets have done it. Katyn. And at that point, it's too late, right? It's in there.
Did Rudenko even know the true facts of either the secret protocols or who was responsible for Katyn? I mean, didn't the Stalinist system of secrecy and paranoia and centralization keep important facts from the prosecutors?
Yes, this is one of the really interesting things about doing this research, was trying to keep track for myself of who knew what when. It's crazy. And yes, I mean, there are these moments. And again, the Soviet archives are really wonderful for this, because there are, in the Foreign Ministry archive, there are all these telegrams. And there's a moment when they're in London, when Rudenko's in London, and, you know, again, like working on the Indictment Act, working on some of these critical documents. And there's an informant in London, a Soviet diplomat, who writes Andrei Vyshinsky, deputy foreign minister, and many other things. And he says, look, I think we have a problem, because, you know, Rudenko doesn't know about the secret protocols. He doesn't even really know some of the details about Soviet-German relations. And this is going to come up in the trial. And like, you know, nobody thought to tell Rudenko. And the reason that they didn't think to tell Rudenko is, again, think back to what we were talking about earlier. The Soviets were out in front arguing for a trial, for a tribunal. They had their own history of trials and tribunals where they expected the prosecution to completely control the script. And so it didn't make any sense to them that the secret protocols would enter into the discussions at all. So, you know, why tell Rudenko? But this is the crazy part. I mean, there's lots of crazy parts here. Ribbentrop, who was the co-signer of this, he's one of the defendants, and he's been in American and British custody. So, you know, at a certain point, they should have thought, like, yeah, maybe this is going to come up. So that's really interesting. And that there are certain members of the Soviet delegation who know the truth, and there are others who don't.
We're talking with Professor Francine Hirsch. Her book is Soviet Judgment, Nuremberg, A New History of the International Military Tribunal After World War II. In addition to the lack of full communication, how much were the Soviet prosecutors hampered just by the centralization and how everything had to go up ultimately to Molotov and Stalin, and that they didn't have enough translators, and that they were wearing shabby clothes, and just day after day, the what it was like to be on the Soviet team in Nuremberg up against Jackson and the others?
Yeah, thank you. I this is one of the things that I found really, really interesting. Again, in the book, I kept trying to like imagine like what would it have been like for these members of the Soviet delegation to be in Nuremberg. One thing I just want to remind people of, again, that how much the Soviets have lost in the war, right? We now know it's like something like 27 million people, the amount of devastation that's been done to their country, right? So they're there with a very serious purpose. They want the world to know what they have suffered. And yet there's a way in which the Soviets, especially at first, and they get the hang of things later. And I should also say that by the time they present their case, they do, like, everyone agrees they've done a fabulous job with their presentations, but that's not for a while. And especially initially, there's a way in which things play a little bit out like a comedy of errors for a number of reasons, right? As you've mentioned, they don't have enough qualified translators and interpreters. And the reason they don't have enough qualified translators and interpreters was that to speak foreign languages in Stalin's Soviet Union, especially during a certain period of the late 1930s and around the time of the war, was incredibly dangerous. German speakers were frequently arrested and shot. And so there are, again, the German speakers that they are people who they're very, very trusted, but there aren't enough of them. And they're struggling. The other thing is the Soviets send to Nuremberg, especially when it comes to public relations, they send amazing writers, amazing political cartoonists. One of the most talented documentary filmmakers, Roman Carman. They're taking this very seriously. And the correspondents that they send, they do an incredible job of writing about the trials for the Soviet press and for the world press. But there are certain things that they've never really had to think about doing before. They don't know how to hold press conferences, for example. And so that's one of the things that they have to kind of get the hang of, and it really hampers them at first. They're also used to keeping information, you know, very secret. And so, again, they're reluctant to even share information about their case that would be interesting for foreign correspondents to cover, right? Because they're not allowed to release certain interesting documents. And the thing about the clothing that you mentioned, that's one of the things, again, that kind of, it's sort of heartbreaking. The other reason that we know all of this is because the Soviets have a whole number of informants in Nuremberg, and even some of the journalists are working as informants who are writing these very detailed reports back to Soviet leaders about everything that's happening there. And some of the things that they talk about are just the facts of just the daily struggles. And they talk about the fact that the female members of the Soviet delegation, the stenographers, the typists, their clothes are really shabby. And it's not just that their clothes are shabby, but they say that the Americans and the British are making fun of them. The issue of centralization, that's a really big one. Because the Soviets had not one, but two secret commissions in Moscow that were supposed to oversee the Soviet delegation from afar and oversee the Soviet case. And so the Soviet judges, the Soviet prosecutors, the members of the Soviet delegation, they're supposed to check in, you know, via Moscow about every decision, really decisions large and decisions small. You know, and how are they supposed to do this? So here they are, again, Nuremberg is in the American zone. They're then transmitting messages to Berlin, and then the messages go from Berlin to Moscow. And then once they get to Moscow, they go, as you say, like up the chain of command. So, and sometimes Molotov signs off on things and edits documents. Occasionally Stalin does too. And then they go, you know, back down and back to Nuremberg. And this takes time. Documents are sometimes lost. Like there are a couple of occasions where documents are lost and the Soviets are just like, just, you know, like floundering, like what do we do? And then even when they get information back, sometimes it's taken so long, the matter's over. The judgment, I'll just say a word about that, because I think that was one of the amazing archival finds. Again, just like the thrill of seeing these documents, right? So the judgment. The judgment deliberations are supposed to be taking place in secret. And the American books about this talk a great deal about how it was in secret. How not only that, like that they would burn the trash every afternoon to make sure that no documents got released to the public. That again, so these are, you know, deliberations about like what should the verdicts be, deliberations about the wording of the judgment, deliberations about the sentencing, right? The Soviet judge manages to sneak out a draft copy of the judgment and send it back to Moscow. And I know this because it is in the Moscow archives and with all kinds of notations all over it. Again, it takes quite a while for it to go through all the necessary people. Then they send back from Moscow like a 12 or 14 page telegram. Yona Nikitchenko, who's the Soviet judge, with details about like, this is not acceptable. Like every single defendant like should be hung. Like, okay, if you have to give in, you can give in here and you can negotiate on this point. You have to make the British judge, Jeffrey Lawrence, understand that the people will not stand for a lenient judgment, right? And just like on and on and on. And, you know, these are marching orders, basically, back to Nikitchenko. By the time he gets them, not that he would have been able to do anything with them at that point, right? But by the time he gets them also, it's really too late. And so he's just floundering and trying to negotiate as best he can, like knowing that these orders are coming. Eventually, Nikitchenko writes a dissent that's written in part, you know, back in Moscow. That inability to be flexible, that expectation that the marching orders are going to come, that really, the judgment is just one example of that, but that really leaves the Soviet delegation at a disadvantage throughout the entire trial and even in the deliberations before.
Turning to one of the most important and best things that the Soviets did, we are taping this conversation on January 28th, the day after International Holocaust Remembrance Day. How much was the world's awareness of the Holocaust advanced by the evidence which the Soviets produced at trial?
I would say that it was significantly advanced by that evidence. I think one of the really interesting things is I think that that has still gone a bit underappreciated in the sense that among Soviet historians for a long time and among others in general, there was a sense that the Soviets suppressed information about like what we now talk about as the Holocaust. And there are a couple of reasons for this. I think in part because in the earlier Soviet war crimes trial, like the Kharkov trial in 1943, the Soviets would refer to all of the victims as peaceful Soviet citizens, even when the victims were almost all Jews, right? And so there was a sense, again, and again, the Soviets, in terms of their narrative, it was a narrative of the suffering of the Soviet people. And so the Jews would show up as part of that, but the emphasis would be on the Soviet, on the suffering of the people as a whole. The other reason is that after Nuremberg, there is an anti, quote unquote, anti-cosmopolitan campaign, an anti-Semitic campaign in the Soviet Union. And actually a number of people who are involved in the trial get caught up in that, because some of them are prominent Jewish members of the cultural elite. And so that's part of why there's that moment has been lost. But at the trial itself, the Soviets presented on crimes against humanity in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. And Lev Smirnov was the Soviet assistant prosecutor who presented that part of the case. And if anyone can go back, the transcript of the trial is available online about Yale University, multiple places, right? The sound recordings have just been released too. And you can go back and you can see, again, all of the evidence that Smirnov introduced. Again, just reports of the Einsatzgruppen, the commanders of the Einsatzgruppen kind of bragging about having fulfilled the orders to annihilate like almost all of the Jews of Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia. Reports from the Polish government they introduce also. One of the reports notes that 3 million Jews have been killed, right, in Poland. And so significant amount of evidence that's still part of the evidentiary record. I think the most powerful part of that Soviet part of the case was the witness testimony. And the Soviets had sent 10 witnesses to Nuremberg. Two of those witnesses, they ended up sending specifically to talk about crimes against humanity focused on the Jews. And one of those witnesses, basically a witness survivor, witness, you know, someone who had seen a lot, was the Yiddish poet Avraham Sutskever, who testifies in the trial, and it's one of those very powerful moments in the trial. Sutskever, we have his diary, and in his diary, it's a very powerful diary where he, again, just talks about his diary of the trial, and he talks about the journey to Nuremberg and the expectations, and that he knows that he's going to testify on behalf of the Jewish people, and he really feels the weight of this. And Sutskever, I should say, one of the things that he, when he was in the ghetto in Vilna, his newborn son was murdered in the ghetto hospital by German soldiers. And so at his testimony in Nuremberg, he's the only Soviet witness who remains standing. And he talks about this as that he had remained standing as if saying Kaddish, the Jewish prayer for the dead. And he talks about the Einsatzgruppen, and he talks about the massacres, he talks about the pogroms, and he talks it's very difficult to read through that testimony for, you know, as someone doing the research as well. He talks about also the murder of his son and that experience too. I think so he's, you know, one of the two, but it's I think a very powerful moment of the trial.
There were also films, actual films of the concentration, yes, camps shown. Do we know what the immediate effect in the courtroom was, including on the defendants?
So the films, some of those films are well, the film footage is, yes, it's quite graphic, and some of the film footage is again of the liberation of some of the camps, and some of the we do know a bit about what the reactions were, in part from journalists who were there and covered it for the newspapers. It's always hard to know what that meant. They would talk about how the defendants turned away from the screen, the defendants looked down, the defendants like took off their headphones, they wouldn't look at it, right? And so I don't know what, right, who knows what they were, right, feeling, but clearly it made some kind of an impact. It made an impact, I would say, though, on everyone, on the members of the other delegations as well, who again agreed that the Soviet case, so the way that part of the case especially was presented, was incredibly powerful. Telford Taylor has a memoir about the trials, and he really talks a lot about the Soviet presentation of crimes against humanity and the Soviet witness testimony. And again, I think was surprised by how powerful it was and how much evidence they had and how much attention that they gave to those details.
We're talking with Professor Francine Hirsch. Her book is Soviet Judgment at Nuremberg, A New History of the International Military Tribunal After World War II. I call the trial the pivot point between World War II and the Cold War. And in fact, one of the formative moments of the Cold War actually happens during the trial when Winston Churchill gives his Iron Curtain speech in March 1946. What was the impact of the Cold War on the trial and of the trial on the Cold War?
No, that's a great question. And it's one of the questions that I kind of was grappling with the book from the start. That was one of my initial elevator pitches about what the book was going to be about. Early on in the trials, there are definitely tensions among the countries of the prosecution, especially between the Soviets and the Americans. But what I think is really interesting that up until March, those tensions are mostly kept under wraps. I mean, we know from Jackson's diaries, we know from Jackson's letters that he resented having to work with the Soviets, right? For all kinds of reasons. He knew about deportations that they were carrying out even as the trial was going on. It's deportations in Poland and deportations in Hungary. But yet they managed to all work together and the prosecution seemed to be like on the same side. But what happens in March, so as you say, Winston Churchill gives his, you know, so-called Iron Curtain speech in the U.S. He is not prime minister anymore, former prime minister, but it's significant that he's giving it in on U.S. territory, right? And then the very next day is the day that the defense case begins. And as the Soviets, we get this from Soviet memoirs, that as the Soviets then enter the courtroom that morning, they see copies of the US Army newspaper Stars and Stripes that are everywhere in the courtroom, like kind of strewn about and being held up by the defense attorneys. And on the big header on it is Unite to Stop the Russians. And Arkady Polterak, who is one member of the Soviet delegation, writes about this in his memoir. And he says that at this moment, he knew that there was a real shift, right? That the mood had shifted, the mood had turned. And again, the timing with the start of the defense case was just like an unhappy coincidence for the Soviets, because the defendants at that point, they're loving this, right? And they've been trying all along to kind of put the wedge in between the Soviets and the other countries of the prosecution. And at that moment, they really up that effort. They're on it. And Hermann Göring, when he gives his testimony, he spends a lot of time, again, talking about the war, which the Soviets have been calling a war of aggression, as a preventive war against the Soviet Union. Ribbentrop, when he gives his testimony, spends a lot of time talking about the secret protocols. And he says, hey, like if we're guilty of crimes against peace, and certainly the Soviets are too. And the research part of this that's interesting is we also have these secret telegrams that the members of the Soviet delegation are sending home as the trial is going on. There's one person who writes back and says, like, I don't understand what's happening here. That we had come to Nuremberg as victors. And suddenly, like, we're being cast as somehow co-conspirators of the Nazis, like what's going on? There's also a very powerful memoir written by one of the Soviet translators, Tatiana Stupnikova, who talks about, again, some of these moments as well, and just how shocking it is to her. Again, she didn't know about the secret protocols before Nuremberg, and now here she is having to translate information about them in court, right? And just kind of stumbling along while doing this because of the shock as well. And again, the Soviets had just finished presenting their case before this happened. That witness testimony of Avraham Sutskever, the other testimony of crimes against peace, they had left a very powerful impression of what they had been through and what they had suffered. And now here's the defense that's trying to do the best it can with some success to kind of undo that impression that had been left.
Is this the moment where they go from having won the war to losing the peace?
Yes, it's through this testimony. It's also through what happens around Katyn as well as part of the defense case. So the Soviets have presented evidence as part of their case on Katyn, and the defendants and their attorneys, they then petition the judges and say, like, hey, like, we'd like to present some evidence about this because this is incorrect. And the Soviets are, they think that this could never happen because, like, we presented evidence. We presented evidence from our official war crimes commission. There's actually an article in the Nuremberg Charter, Article 21, that says that, you know, information presented by a war crimes commission is incontrovertible. But, like, but what does incontrovertible mean? You know, it turns out that incontrovertible means it can be accepted, but it can still be disputed, right? And so they allow the defense, and again, Nikitchenko is the Soviet judge. He's voted down 3-1 about a whole number of things during the defense case. And this is one of them where they say, okay, the defendants can bring in 3 witnesses and the Soviets can have 3 witnesses too. And so you have in July, this kind of, you know, battle of the witnesses as it is. And everyone agrees kind of like, it's not clear really, like, it kind of vanishes, but Katyn is not included in the judgment. But by that point, people think, yeah, the Soviets, you know, probably did it. So I think, yeah, it's with the information about the secret protocols. It's with the information that comes out about Katyn. This is where things shift. And, you know, the other thing is everyone had agreed, it's in the Nuremberg Charter, that the trial was just supposed to be about European Axis crimes. So that was from the start. So the Soviets, again, they think from the start they're going to be in the clear. Second, Jackson, before the trial started, at Jackson's initiative, the prosecutors had a discussion. He asked them, like, is there anything we should know? Like, is there anything that might come up during the trial that we should know about so that we know how to deal with it during the trial? He basically is asking for them to kind of come clean about any issues that they think might be an issue, right? That might be a problem. And so this prompts in Moscow, they take it as like, oh, we'll have a taboo list, a list of topics that should be stayed away from. And on that taboo list are things like Soviet Union's relationship to Poland and the non-aggression pact and all of its parts, you know? And so, and of course, like, the judges aren't in on that agreement. And so what happens is that things in Nuremberg, and again, it's important to emphasize this, things in Nuremberg, they stay pretty congenial. And they stay pretty congenial in part because they're all in the courtroom by day, they're all drinking by night. And there are all kinds of parties, and as the weather gets nicer, there's pool parties, and Nikitchenko plays tennis with the other judges, and so things are okay. But back in Moscow, man, they're not happy at all. And I think at this point, Soviet leaders, they're really starting to see all of these 3-1 decisions against Nikitchenko. They start to see it as part of an Anglo-American plot, and so this is part of the Cold War story in the sense that by the end of the trials, the Soviets are convinced that things have gone against them because of these Cold War tensions that are coming up, of course, in other spheres at this time, too. It's not just in Nuremberg, but that's part of their reading of it. And then that also affects their relationship and their attitude towards other international institutions afterwards as well.
Understanding Russia and the Soviet Union has been a very large part of your academic life's work. When did you first realize that there was more to the story of Nuremberg and what you call the myth of the Nuremberg moment than had been the accepted narrative?
Oh, that's such an interesting question. I love that. Some of it is, I think it's always interesting to think about like how people get to different projects, get to different topics, right? And my way into this topic was partly through the filmmaker Roman Carman, who I had become really interested in. And at first I thought I was going to write something like a project just about Roman Carman. And Roman Carman, again, was this amazing filmmaker, documentary filmmaker. He did all these films of the National Republics in the Soviet Union. And I had been interested in that for my first project. I found out that Roman Carman had been at Nuremberg and had made the Soviet Union's like big documentary film about the Nuremberg trials. And I thought that was pretty interesting. And then Aron Tryinin was also someone who I had come across during my first project because he wrote a number of works about race and genocide. And my first book was about nationality problem. And so again, I found out that Aron Tryinin had been at Nuremberg. So I was like, huh, Tryinin was at Nuremberg, Carman was at Nuremberg, like who else was at Nuremberg? Like what role did the Soviets have at Nuremberg? And so I just became interested in that. And some, again, reading the popular books on Nuremberg and even some of the academic books on Nuremberg, there wasn't much about the Soviets. Actually, interestingly, David Irving's book on the Nuremberg trials. That was one of the first books I noted that had some more talk about the Soviets. And I was like, huh, that's kind of strange. And even like a reference to a Soviet archival source from a Russian. So I was like, what is this? Like, what role did the Soviets have? Like, what's the story here? So I went to Moscow. And, you know, as one does to do research if you're a Soviet historian. And I started doing research in the archives. And it was really then that the story started to come together and that I got a sense that, oh, the Soviets, they weren't just a second bit player here, but they actually had a really important role in the trials as well. That was the journey.
Apparently the Soviets were not familiar with the Stringer Bell rule and took notes on a criminal conspiracy. To talk a bit about what you found in the archives and the secret telegrams and the encrypted work and the surveillance reports. And were you surprised at how much documentation there was?
I was shocked by how much documentation there was. I was also shocked by just the nature of the sources and how interesting they were, right? I started, I worked in five different Moscow archives, and I started the book doing research in like the state archive of the Russian Federation. And that's where like the transcript of the Nuremberg trials like was stored. But while looking through some of those files, I started to find some of these surveillance reports, right? And that's why I found one of the most interesting, the document when I knew I wanted to work on the book, it wasn't like the high secret stuff. It was the 6-page report by this journalist editor, Mikhail Dolgopolov was his name. And he was writing back about the terrible housing conditions in Nuremberg. And he was writing back about, again, the problems with the translators. And he was writing back about like anti-Soviet attitudes among people he was meeting in Germany and those kinds of things. And that was really, really interesting. And then, you know, for a while, some of the most important documents for the book were from the Foreign Ministry Archive. And it took me quite a while to get permission to work there. So I worked in these other archives while I was waiting for permission to work there. And I didn't know if I'd get permission at all. It's very hard to get permission to work in that particular archive. And once you get in there, it's one of those archives where they keep the archive guide locked in a glass case that, you know, they don't give you the key to. So eventually they sort of let me see the guide, but you have to go in having a sense of what you want to see. And there, that was when I would see these marked up reports. And that was when I would see where I saw a bunch of these telegrams and like all of that really detailed information. And some of the, and like, again, the Soviets had two secret commissions, right, that oversaw what the delegation, and some of those secret commissions, some of their reports, I find them in various archives, actually. Some were in the party archive and some were in the state archive, and there's be some copies. So they were kind of all over the place. And putting some of that together too, that's when they would talk about like all kinds of problems, like their annoyance at the Americans for trying to hoard evidence. They would talk about the question of which witnesses should they call for to testify about Katyn, like which witnesses would be the most trustworthy. So those kinds of things. There's the archives are really fun, and that part of the research was great. In the literature and art archive too, I got to see, again, personal papers and diaries of people like Roman Carman, the filmmaker, the playwright, Vyacheslav Vishnevsky. And again, you just got a sense of the trial, but just also Nuremberg as this kind of microcosm where all of these people from these countries had been kind of thrown together after the war, and how the Soviets were just making sense of that world that they suddenly found themselves in.
Given the nature of the Stalinist system at the time, could you necessarily believe that what you read in the archives was true?
So I guess it depends on like what kinds of documents, right? I mean, I would say that the Carmen and Vishnevsky's, their letters, and you know, and their people know who they're writing to. Let's put it that way. So when you read these surveillance reports, when the people are reporting on each other and saying like these people shopped on the black market, and right, you know that like that probably happened, but the fact that it's in a report because they know that someone in Moscow is interested, right, in that kind of information. In terms of the transcripts of the secret meetings to discuss what's going on in Nuremberg, those transcripts were pretty secret. Like you had to go through many levels to be able to look at them. And the Soviets, yeah, they kept those kinds of transcripts. So I think, again, anytime you do archival research of any country, but especially probably a state like the Soviet Union, you have to read lots of different documents and read them against each other. And some of what you're trying to figure out, it's not just about truth, right? It's about perspective. It's about like, what did they think was going on? What did they think they needed to report about what was going on? The Katyn stuff, now that's a whole different set of questions, right? Because we know that the Soviets had fabricated evidence that was then used at Katyn. And some of that documentation, like I haven't been able to see. Some of that I've had to rely on Russian scholars who are pretty high up, who had managed to get access to it and had managed to get access to it at an earlier time when that wasn't such a controversial issue in Russia. So again, in terms of access and the stories that are being told, some of that changes over time. Some of the materials that I worked with, I did my archival research in the summers of 2005 and 2006. And some of the archive, they're called archival, well, so I'll say some of the collections that I worked in have now been closed because the politics have changed. And so you can't get in there now. And so, again, it depends on the political moment.
So that's pretty good timing for you.
It was really good timing. Yeah.
This was the only four power trial. There, individual nations would hold their own trials, but looking at the range of the verdicts and the sentences for the IMT at Nuremberg, was justice done?
So that's an interesting question. I mean, one of the things that I grappled with in this book was this idea of justice, right? Like what is justice? What do we think of as justice? And what did the participants in the tribunal think of as justice? The Soviets did not think justice was done, right? For the Soviets, for justice to have been done, every single defendant would have been hung, right? The Americans, I think, thought that justice was done in the sense that the American judges and they really wanted to go out of their way to give like every benefit, right, of doubt, and to have a trial that followed rule of law, right, as closely as possible. And again, there's different, for the Soviets, you have to prove your innocence. For the Americans, you have to prove guilt, right? So just in that sense. But I don't even feel like I'm qualified to say if justice was done. I feel that it's the people who, again, on Holocaust, you know, the day after Holocaust Remembrance Day, people who just, how can justice ever be done, right? What does that mean for justice to be done in a case like this, right? It was a trial. I think that they collected significant amount of evidence and they showed that evidence. They had all of this witness testimony. I think all of that was really positive. It's especially now when there's still efforts to deny the Holocaust, to deny just the extent of what Nazi Germany had done, right? To have all of that evidence collected, I think that is one of the most important legacies, I would say, of the Nuremberg trials. I think whether justice was done, it's such an individual question in some ways. And I don't know. I get stuck on that one every time.
But for all the evidence about the Holocaust, it was only the murders after September 1st, 1939 that counted in guilty verdict.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. They really, And again, that's one of those questions about these competing prerogatives, right? There was this concern to have this trial. There was also a concern about state sovereignty. And part of why they tied crimes against humanity to the war was because of a concern about, well, if you were to try Nazi leaders for crimes committed before the war that were not connected with the war, that were not connected with the conspiracy, then you're trying leaders of a state for their actions. Now, granted, this was what was confined within the Nuremberg trial. And I would say it was only the French in these discussions, the four power discussions before the trial started about how to define crimes against humanity. The French were the ones who pushed back against this. The French wanted a broader definition of crimes against humanity. The French representative in London, where they were working on the Nuremberg Charter, he said that it would be a travesty, right, to not have a broader definition. What they were talking about at the time is crimes against civilians, and then they called it crimes against humanity. It would be a travesty not to have a broader definition that included those crimes that Germany had committed against its own population. And afterwards, I think it was that desire to push against those boundaries, right, that's what led to some of the post-Nuremberg discussions about genocide and crimes against humanity and human rights and some of the declarations and legislation that we got in the United Nations. But again, state sovereignty, that's one of those issues that just kept coming up, and it still does to this day, because, you know, after Nuremberg, there was an effort to take these ideas that were in the Nuremberg Charter and the Nuremberg Judgment, and again, like certain crimes were crimes against humanity, and to extend it, to take away the idea that it had to be connected to the launching of a war, to hold governments and leaders accountable, right? So there was a big push to do this and to integrate what was called then the Nuremberg Principles into a new international law code and to create a new international criminal court. And it just kept stalling. It kept stalling. And again, it kept stalling because of concerns about state sovereignty. And so even now today, right, this is, again, to come back when there's, you know, we have it, there's an international criminal court, but some countries don't want to belong to it. Some countries don't want to have anything to do with it. It's because of state sovereignty. And I don't know how you get around that. I hope at some point states can.
Finally, 75 years later, what is the legacy of the International Military Tribunal?
I think one of the important legacies is the historical record that it produced, the fact that we have all of this information. I think in terms of thinking about the Nuremberg story, right, like we still like to hold up the story of the Americans. I think it would be good to expand that and really think more about the four power cooperation that was involved in the trial and have that be part of the legacy that we appreciate more. I think there are a lot of lessons there about ways in which you can cooperate and ways in which maybe you don't want to, right? Where you hold the moral line. And I think that's one of the things that I certainly thought a lot about as I was working on the book. I think, again, you know, we have this Nuremberg myth still, the myth of the Nuremberg moment. And I think the Nuremberg moment, it really did open the way for new ideas and legislation about crimes against humanity and human rights and thinking about genocide. And that is all a very important part of the Nuremberg, of its legacy. But again, the part of the legacy is also a way in which the Cold War and ideas of human rights became entangled with each other. And that's part of the legacy that we don't talk about as much either. And I think we need that story too, to understand not just what Nuremberg was able to accomplish and what was able to be accomplished in Nuremberg's name after the trials, but also to be able to understand where Nuremberg and the Nuremberg principles fell short. That question of state sovereignty that came up, I think that's in part because of this mistrust from Nuremberg and the Cold War becoming so intertwined. And I think that's part of the legacy too.
I'm afraid that's where we're going to have to leave it, because that is all the time we have with Professor Francine Hirsch. Again, the book is Soviet Judgment at Nuremberg, A New History of the International Military Tribunal After World War II. It's from the good people at Oxford University Press, and it's the best kind of history, really well written about something that happened a while ago, but is still relevant today. On behalf of News and Public Affairs Director Sholly Pittman and all of us here at Madison BookBeat, I'm Stu Levitan. Thank you for joining us. Now, as Ben Sidran plays us out with a little bit of Little Sherry, please stay tuned for Alex Wilding White and All Around Jazz. You're listening to WORT 89.9 FM Madison, listener-sponsored community radio.
Bluestem Jazz presents Chad McCullough's Modal Horizons, the music of Jim Knapp, featuring Jay Thomas, on Friday, May 8th, 8 p.m. at the Borough. Chicago native Jim Knapp had a long and storied career with affiliations as varied as John Cage, Sam Rivers, Anthony Braxton, Manfred Eicher, and Gil Evans. For the first time in many years, his music will be performed in the Midwest, with a world-class 13-piece ensemble led by Chicago trumpeter Chad McCullough, along with trumpeter and saxophonist Jay Thomas. More information can be found at bluestemjazz.org. Bluestem Jazz presents Chad McCullough's Modal Horizons, the music of Jim Knapp, featuring Jay Thomas, on Friday, May 8th, 8 p.m. at the Burr Oak. Live music lives at WORT Madison.
The Bonfire Music and Arts Festival is at the Driftless Music Gardens Thursday, June 6th through Saturday, June 8th. Now in its 18th year, Bonfire Music and Arts Festival is a weekend of music, art, mindfulness, and community. Bonfire hosts two stages of national and local music, as well as yoga and wellness activities designed for the whole family. Included in this year's lineup are Adam Gruhl and the Space Burritos, The Big Woo, Jaden James, plus Locals Work, Cribs Hitter, and a couple of sets from the People Brothers Band. A full lineup of bands and activities can be found at driftlessmusicgardens.com. Bonfire Music and Arts Festival is in Yuba, Wisconsin, Thursday, June 6th through Saturday, June 8th. This is WORT 89.9 FM Madison and WORTFM.org.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and ResTech Services.